listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. What does it mean to have dreams even in a time of war? What does it mean to be the fifth child of the third wife among 24 children in a country at war? What does it mean to walk 6 miles to and from school barefoot because you have a thirst for knowledge? As a young boy, Gugi Wationgo's favorite book was Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. He and his best friend Kenneth discussed the possibility of going to sea to become pirates. We are fortunate that the port of Mombasa was very far away and that Gugi persevered in hanging on to those dreams in time of war because rather than a pirate, he became a world-renowned novelist, playwright, critic, and memoirist. His books include Wizard of the Crow, Petals of Blood, Devil on the Cross, and Decolonizing the Mind. And his new book, Dreams in a Time of War, is an evocative memoir of childhood in rural Kenya. It's very moving. In 1977, Gugi wrote a play, I Will Marry When I Want, which was sharply critical of the inequalities and injustices of Kenyan society. After the play was performed in an open-air theater in Kenya, he was arrested, then imprisoned without charge in a maximum security prison. During that imprisonment, he wrote the novel Devil on the Cross on toilet paper. Amnesty International named him a prisoner of conscience, and an international campaign secured his release a year later. He continued to be critical of the Moi dictatorship and was eventually forced into exile. His work has been translated into more than 30 languages, and he is the recipient of many honors. Gugi Wationgo is currently a distinguished professor of English and comparative literature at UC Irvine. We're very honored to have him here tonight. And as well, the novelist Leila Lalami, who will be in conversation with Gugi tonight. Leila was born and raised in Morocco. Her writing has appeared in many publications. She has also received many awards, and she is the author of the short story collection Hope and Other Dangerous Pursuits, and the novel Secret Sun, which the New York Times Book Review called a nuanced depiction of the roots of Islamic terrorism, written by someone who intimately knows one of the stratified societies where it grows. Leila earned her PhD in linguistics from USC, and her work has been translated into 10 languages. She's currently Associate Professor of Creative Writing at UC Riverside. Please join me in welcoming Gugi Wationgo and Leila Lalami to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. It really is a pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you very much, Louise, for inviting me to speak. And I have to say what an honor it is to share the stage with Gugi, whose books I remember very well being assigned when I was in college, and who truly hit me with the force of revelation. So it really is a special treat, and I had planned that actually on bringing my copies, the old orange-colored Heinemann edition copies of those books, but with traffic, anyway, we got all sidelined, we didn't bring it. So we will each be reading very briefly from the books. I'll be reading from Secret Sun, which has just came out in paperback. This is a book set in Morocco and is about one young man who at the beginning of the book discovers the truth about his father. So I'll be reading from the first chapter. This is called The Year of the Flood. The rain came unexpectedly after nearly 3 years of drought. In those days, Yusuf still lived with his mother in a whitewashed house that huddled with others like it along a narrow dirt road. The house had one room with no windows and a roof made of corrugated tin held down by rocks. The yard where his mother did the cooking and the washing was open to the sky. It was in the yard that she cleaned the sheep hides she took in on the day of Eid, and there Yusuf received the rare friends who came to visit. The front door was painted blue, but over the years, rust had eaten its edges, turning them reddish brown, so that holes had begun to appear at each of the four corners. They were having lunch when it began to drizzle, the thin raindrops making craters as they landed on the fava bean soup. Yusuf's mother looked up at the sky for a few surprised seconds, and then, as though a spark had ignited inside her, she jumped to her feet, grabbed the soup pot by its ears, and took it to the bedroom. Yusuf's first thought was of the framed black-and-white picture of his father, which hung on the yard wall above the divan. He took it inside, wiping the raindrops off the glass with the hem of his shirt. His father gazed back at him, a young man in his 20s, in a dark suit and gray tie, with his hair combed back neatly, as if he were on his way to an important appointment. His smile was timid, or perhaps reluctant, Yusuf had never been able to tell. He left the picture next to his bed and went back outside. His mother had already picked up the bowls and the loaf of bread, so he grabbed the radio and carried it to the water closet. He lifted the divan on which they had been sitting and positioned it on its side, under the green awning that ran from the kitchen corner to the front door. There was just enough room there for the table as well. His mother finished collecting the laundry. Now everything was safe. They stood together at the door of the bedroom, arms folded, watching the rain. "The year might turn out to be good," Yusuf said. He was thinking of the farm laborers who had been moving into the city, chased by the drought. They came from the Gharb, from the Shawiya, and even from as far south as Marrakesh, here to Casablanca, where their teenage children crowded the markets and drove down wages for every kind of labor. Maybe this year there wouldn't be as many of them. His mother looked up at him. "We're already in March," she said. "It's too late for the rain to do most crops any good." "Your flowers at least won't mind it," Yusuf said, glancing at the row of potted daisies, roses and gardenias under the laundry lines. One by one, she had rescued the flowers from the trash cans at the hospital where she worked, brought them home, and nursed them back to health. It was a rare indulgence. She was a woman who valued work over pleasure, utility over beauty. And she herself was beautiful. The week before, she had turned 39, and though her hair was streaked with gray and her forehead lined with wrinkles, her green eyes and high cheekbones gave her a distinguished, almost aristocratic look. At length, they sat down on the straw mat facing the open door. Yusuf's mother dipped her bread in the thick soup and tasted it. "It's all cold now," she said. "I'll reheat it for you." "Don't trouble Yusuf and me," he said. Always she doted on him like this, as though he were 8 instead of 18. Even though he discouraged her constant attention, it never occurred to him to resent it. He was, after all, her only child. When they finished eating, he put on his sneakers and checked his watch. He wondered what movie he would see this week at the Star Cinema. But even before he could ask his mother for ticket money, she was already sorting through her purse. She handed him a coin. "Don't forget your jacket," she said. He left the house, hunching his shoulders against the light rain, and headed for the theater. The Star was not, strictly speaking, a cinema. This would have been obvious to anyone who visited the dilapidated building that stood across from a butcher and a tailor on one of the garbage-strewn alleyways of Hayin Najat. Nevertheless, that was the name that a Casablanca charitable association had given to the place where, every week, a new, older movie was projected on a cracked screen and where patrons competed with rats for space on the gutted seats. For 5 dirhams, Yusuf could watch Hong Kong action films, Bollywood romances, Egyptian dramas, or American blockbusters. He never missed a show. All his life, he had dreamed of becoming an actor. He had performed in the only play his high school had ever put on, a reenactment of the Green March, and he had spent long afternoons playing football, hoping to have the athletic chest that was appropriate for the moment when, shirtless, he would raise the Moroccan flag and lead his fellow civilians to reclaim the Spanish border post in the Sahara. He loved inhabiting the life of the hero, loved feeling his triumph, and when the audience applauded a surge of euphoria, much like the one he had felt when he had tried hashish with Amin and Mati, ran through him. Of course, Yusuf knew that his dream was unachievable, no different than wanting to win the lottery when you can't even afford to buy a ticket. but it provided a refuge from the more sobering turns he knew his life would by necessity have to take. Finish high school, go to university, and with any luck, find a steady job that would finally get his mother and him out of Hay and Najat. This week, the Star Cinema was showing Boys in the Hood. Right away, Yusuf knew that it would not be a big hit with his friends. There were no explosions, no car chases, and most unforgivable of all, only one naked woman, and she didn't even face the camera. But he stayed glued to his seat because of Lawrence Fishburne's fatherly presence, his smooth voice, and limitless experience. Yusuf had lost his own father at the age of 2, so his memories were few and faint. He remembered a tall man walking through the doorway, a hand tousling his hair, the smell of a stuffed pipe at night, but maddeningly, little else. Whatever tangible knowledge he had of his father came to him at second hand from his mother. Nabil El-Mekki was a fourth grade teacher, respected by colleagues and students alike for his dedication. Back then, the family lived in an apartment in the Fez Medina, though Nabil often worked odd jobs at night or on weekends to save enough money for a house. Some neighbors who were preparing for a big Eid party asked him to hang lights on their roof. He tripped on a wire and fell down 3 floors, breaking his neck on a cart filled with roasted sheep heads. He died instantly. It was an accident, the doctors said, though everyone called it fate, maktoub, for how else could one accept that such a young man had died so needlessly? Of course, Yusuf and his mother weren't the only people in Hay Najat without a father or a husband, but they seemed to be the only ones without any family. She was an orphan, having been raised in the French orphanage at Beb Ziet. After her husband's death, she had moved from Fez to Casablanca, but refused to stay in touch with Nabil's parents, who had cheated her out of her meager inheritance. This was why, growing up, Yusuf had often felt that he and his mother were both unmoored somehow. And I will stop right there. Thank you.
It's also giving me great pleasure to share this platform with you. The strong mother in your novel actually reminds me of my own very strong mother in this narrative. Only mine is not fiction, it is a memoir. But I can identify with that relationship between mother and child. And so the first section I'm going to read concerns my mother. I come from a polygamous household. I was the 5th child of the 3rd wife of my father. And since wherever I have been on this book tour from London, the question which has been posed to me, the first question is always about polygamy. Even on BBC television and radio. So I've decided to be starting with that particular, in case there's the same question is somewhere at the back of anybody's mind in this audience. But in a sense, it is an old question, old one, because we used to ask my mother the same question as my sisters, who saw that they would never, never marry anybody with another wife. They would never be the second wives or third wives of anybody. So they would often tease her, why did you choose to marry into polygamy? My mother, Wanjiko, was of few words, but those words carried the authority of the silence that preceded their utterance. Now and then, words would gush from her mouth, opening a little window into her soul. I once asked her, during one of those moments of well-being that follow a good steaming meal, why did you consent to polygamy? Why did you accept being the third wife of my father, who already had older children, almost your age? It was because of his two first wives, she said, and their children. She said, with light and shadows from the wood fire playing on her face. They were always together, such harmony. And I often wondered how it would feel to be in their company. And your father, he was not to be denied. I don't know how he knew where I worked in my father's fields, well, your grandfather's, but he would somehow appear, just a smile, and say a few words. What a pity if such a hard-working beauty should ever team up with a lazy man, he would tease me. Those were no small words coming from a man who had so many goats and cows, and he had acquired all that wealth by his own toil. But I did not want him to think that I would simply fall for his words and reputation. And I challenged him, how do I know that you are not one of those who work their wives to death, then claim the wealth came from his hands alone? The following day, he came back, a hoe on his shoulder, as if to prove that he did not include himself among the lazy. And without waiting for my invitation even, he started to work. It became a playful but serious competition to see who would tire first. I held my own, she said with a touch of pride in her prowess. The only break was when I lit a fire and roasted some potatoes. Don't you think you and I should combine our strengths in a hoe? He again asked. I said, just because of one day's work on a field already broken? Another day, he found me trying to clear some bush to expand my farm. He joined in the clearing, and by the end of the day, we were both exhausted, but neither of us would admit to it. He went away, and I thought he would never appear again. But he did come back on another day, without a hole, but an enigma of a smile on his face. Oh, yes, such a day it was. The crop was in bloom, the entire field covered with pea flowers of different colors. And I always remember the butterflies, so many, and I was not afraid of the bees that competed with the butterflies. He took out a bead necklace and said, will you wear this for me? Well, I did not say yes or no, but I took it and wore it, she said with an audible sigh. My mother would not answer follow-up questions, but what she had said was enough to tell me how she became the third of my father's wives, but not sufficient to tell me how she came to lose her place as the youngest and latest to Jerry, the fourth wife, or even how she felt about the new addition to the family. I was born in 1938, as you read from this memoir, under the shadow of the Second World War. And so war, and then this was followed by Mau Mau, War of Liberation in Kenya. So really I was born under the shadow of the Second World War, and I grew up, you know, at least my childhood, you know, under the shadow of, or inactive, in the active environment of the Mau Mau War, okay? But I also was interested in looking back to see how events far away could still affect a small village, you know, far from the theater of the action. In this connection, I take the example of the Second World War. Now I just want to read just a little bit from that. One of my brothers, half-brothers, was in a war, Second World War, but I had never met him. So we heard of him in different places and so on, and, this soldier fighting for King George, and around the fireside where we told stories or where stories were exchanged, you know, we would hear of names of strange people like Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt, and places, America, Germany, Italy, Russia, Japan, Madagascar, and Burma. These occasionally cropped up in the story sessions at our Gary's father's firesides. These names and places were vague in outline. Yeah. But I always longed to see, always wished that my half-brother would come home, okay? And one day, he came home in an army truck, two headlights splitting the darkness. There was not much of a road to a homestead. The truck simply made two tracks past Lord Kahau's orchard to our compound. Unfortunately, it had been raining. The truck got stuck in the mud, and as the driver tried to rev it out, the truck hit my mother's hat and dug deeper in the mud. The army men in green khaki fatigues and army hats spent most of their night visit trying to dig it out, using flashlights to see. We crowded around him, and I could not even make out who Kafai, that's my brother, was, except when he, a shadowy figure among shadowy figures, left his men digging and said hurried greetings to the family. He was back from the East African campaign, resting and recharging in Nairobi before redeployment to other fronts in Madagascar or even Burma. By the time they had dug out the truck, they could only eat hurriedly, and they were anxious to leave and return to camp in Nairobi. So we did not spend much time with him, but I hardly slept, thinking of the drama that had just ended. It was as if my half-brother had jumped out of a story, said a hello, a goodbye, and then jumped back into the story. Hitting my mother's heart and digging out the truck at night was not exactly the most heroic homecoming for one who had been all over the world fighting ogres, but then his was really the first motor vehicle ever to come to our homestead. The visit was forever engraved in my mind, and talks of the big war now always brought back memories of a military truck stuck in the mud and my mother's heart. And then quickly, something else which I want to share with you very, very quickly. He lives, my brother lives, right to the war. I don't know how long it was after Kafai's visit, but more magical happenings followed. A white man came to our homestead. Although white people owned the tea plantations on the other side of the railway, and I had never and had even heard that there were white owners of the Limuru Buttershoe Factory near our home, the nearest thing to a white man I had seen at close quarters were the Indian shopkeepers. But here was a real white man on foot in our homestead, and we ran by his side calling out, "Modogo, Modogo," that means European white man, white man. He said something like "Bono" or "Buena," and then asked for eggs. My mother gave him some, even refusing his money in exchange, and he uttered something like "Gracia" and went away saying "Ciao," which we took for yet another word for thank you. We followed behind him, a crowd of children still calling out, white man, white man. And then came the shock. We saw white men making a road, white men who were not supervising blacks, but were actually breaking the stones themselves. Later, more of these workmen came to our place asking for eggs or mayai, throwing out words like buonasera, buongiorno, pronto, gracias. But the word that was most frequent and common to all of them, and the one that lingered in the mind, was bono. So we nicknamed them bono. I would learn that they were Italian prisoners of war taken between May and November 1941, when the Italians surrendered, ending the East African campaign. Okay, and then two small pieces. One, I need to read this because the joy of... I grew up listening to stories around the fireside, but I always longed to hear the stories even when the sessions were not on. But our mothers always told us that the stories fled in daytime, so we could not hear any story in the daytime. And then I went to school, and you read about that, you know, here. But anyway, and then I learned how to read. And my first book was actually an old sort of torn copy of the Old Testament, or stories culled from that. You know, but so this was very exciting. And then there was another book, just an ordinary reader, Kikuyu reader. And then, let me share this with you anyway, how I felt at the time. I don't know about the best that I could have done. By the way, that's because my mother, no matter what I did, my mother would always ask me whether that was the best. Even if I got 10 out of 10, she would still ask me whether that was really the best I could have done. No, I don't know about the best that I could have done. All I know is that one day I'm able to read on my own the Gikuyu primer we use in a class titled Mothomere wa Gikuyu. Some sentences are simple, like the one captioning a drawing of a man, an axe on the ground, his face grimacing with pain as he holds his left knee in both hands and drops of blood trickling down. The picture is more interesting than the words. Kamau etemete, etemete kuru, etemete neidanua. Kamau has cut himself. He has cut his leg. He has cut himself with an axe. I tackle long sentences that do not have illustrations. There's a passage that I read over and over again. And suddenly, one day, I started hearing music in the words. God has given the Gikuyu a beautiful country, abundant in water, food, and luscious bush. The Gikuyu should praise the Lord all the time, for he's ever been generous to them. Even when not reading it, I can hear the music. The choice and arrangements of the words, the cadence, I can't pick any one of the things that makes it so beautiful and long-lived my memory. I realize that even written words can carry music that I loved in stories, particularly the choric melody. And yet, this is not a story. It is a descriptive statement. It does not carry an illustration. It is the picture in itself, and yet more than a picture and a description. It is music. Written words can also sing. Thank you.
So thank you for that. I love the passages that you read, and I actually have a number of questions. I was trying to, there was so much that I want to ask you, but let me just begin by saying that this book, Dreams in a Time of War,
Like that? Oh, these gadgets, you know.
That would help. It's such a fascinating read. I mean, it was at least for me, and I think for all of your fans, because it really, in it, you really provide a context and explore the roots really of your commitment to freedom and independence and social justice in general. And you talk about your childhood in Limuru, but you also explore a number of relationships. Some of these are familiar, and you mentioned them, so the relationship with your father, with your mother, with the other mothers, with the siblings, and the extended family, but there are also political relationships, for example, between the indigenous people of Kenya and the British settlers, the Indian community, the Italian prisoners of war that you mentioned in this passage. And yet, at the heart of this book, it seemed to me, was really a love letter to your mother, Wanjiku Wangugi. Is this who you had in mind when you were working on the book?
Well, my mother, Wanjiku, had really this very, very big impact on me. And I said, when you're reading that passage from my own work, actually I saw my mother in that picture only. Of course, she's in a rural environment.
Yes. You know,
but really, that relationship was very, very interesting. I couldn't identify with the young Muslim.
Yes.
I could identify really, you know, with him. Now, the remarkable thing about my mother, a peasant, living on the land, was that she did not know how to read or write. But she's the one who posed the question about my going to school. And for many years, she supervised my homework. Which meant that she would ask many probing questions. Okay. So I always had the impression that she knew how to read and write, you know. And then her constant question was always, is that the best you could have done? Yeah. It was, and I've said this in the book, it's as if she was really more interested in the process itself, you know. So for her, it did not matter whether you got 10 out of 10, but whether in getting 10 out of 10, you had put in the best that you could have put into that process. Later, she read from the Dreams and Time of War. Of course, the polygamous relationship didn't work out all that great, but she was a constant figure in my biological family. Yeah. So she's passed on now, you know, but I always, she's very much in my mind all the time, quite frankly. And she died when I was in exile in London. Mm-hmm. And actually I knew that she had died, I don't know how, but when I was told that she had been taken to or something, ill or something, I don't know why I knew, you know, that I knew. And the day she died, I knew it because, you know, I was walking in one of the streets in London and tears started falling down my my cheeks. And I knew that was the day.
Happened to her.
Yeah, that was the day she died. Yeah.
It really, when I was reading that, that passage really resonated with me too, because when I remember actually being a child and having my father be this person for me, be the person who was always asking, is this the best that you could do? Is this, you know, is this the best grade that you can get? And in a sense, that has been a driving force in my life. But in writing the novel, I find myself being uncomfortable from writing from from the point of view of the same person. So that's why it's easier to, for me anyway, to turn it into this young man and have the other person be the mother and work on it from that perspective.
I must say, just a quick response to that one. Actually, it's very interesting. This memoir is my first memoir.
Right.
And I know that in my other memoir of prison life, you know, political prison,
right,
called Detained, somebody drew my attention the other day to the fact, and they read that passage to me, where I had said that I had been asked by many people to write my memoir, and I said I would never write a memoir of my life because I thought it would be so dull, there was nothing to say, and so on, you know. And really what the person who was very keen on my writing this memoir, actually my wife, Jerry Wango, who is not actually here, she's having another function of her own in Los Angeles. Anyway, she was very keen that I write my memoir for a number of things, actually mainly for our children and the grandchildren, but because of this. Our two last borns, Thiong'o and Mo, were born in New Jersey. And when they were growing up, they wanted to have this energy to them to understand how, you know, to get motivated and so on. So, you know, so I'll tell them stories how I used to go on foot for 6 miles to school, thinking that this would really, you know, sort of. And then Thiong'o turned around and said, "But Daddy, your parents were very mean. Why could they not drive you to school?" And then shoes. I did not have shoes. He was even more puzzled. How they could be so mean as not to even provide me with the shoes and so on. So that didn't work. What actually eventually worked was actually when we took them to Kenya.
Oh.
And they lived with their auntie, and then went to a local school for a year, where they actually went on foot, and they could. When they came back, they never asked those kind of questions. Yeah, that's sorry.
Funny.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, funnily enough, my father used to say the same things to me when I was a child. Oh, you know, you kids have it so easy. We used to walk miles to school. We didn't have, you know, it's the exact same thing. So it is sort of like a flashback hearing these stories. The scene that you read where your mother, actually, this wasn't the scene that you read, but it is a scene in the book where the mother, your mother, is asking you if you want to go to school. And she asks, "Are you sure?" And then you say yes. And then she asks, "But, you know, you will not complain if you don't have a midday meal." And you say, no, I won't complain. I want to go to school. And it was, to me, it was fascinating that this is almost word for word the scene that opens Weep Not, Child. But it's in a fictional context, is it not?
Yeah. That's true, the same scene, actually, more or less, you know. And that's why that's the difference between writing a novel. I suppose the same thing you have, what you said earlier about your own work, in drawing from, you know, because all writers, you know, I'm sure, you know, you, me, every writer, we draw very much from our own experiences. Actually, the real resource we have is our own experience, not necessarily direct in the sense that this and this happened to me, but the emotional environment of our growing up, you know, we draw upon that, all the time. So I wrote my first novel when I was a student at Macquarie College in 19.
Right.
I remember this, early 60s anyway. And at first I could not write about myself at all or anything, but then that particular scene, again, is the one which opens Weep Not, Child. Mm-hmm. Only that whatever happened to Joroge, the main character there, is not necessarily what happened to me. Yeah. But I drew from that experience. Yeah.
Right. And two, when we read this book, it's very difficult not to get the sense that on top of it being the story of your life and all these familial relationships, that it is a story of a country, because there's so much that happens in the background. There's, for example, in the passage that you were reading earlier with your father wooing your mother, and one of the things that was being said about your father was that he had all those goats, and so he was considered a rich man because he had all the goats, but during the course of the book, you explain that, in fact, the reason he had to start from scratch was because the land on which, the land that belonged to his family had been stripped from them and given to this man who was essentially collaborating with the British settlers. And then there's the older brother who goes into the Mau Mau rebellion. Mm. So it's almost like getting the story of the struggle for independence with Kenya.
Yeah, because what I was interested in, and again, a parallel between me and you are very interesting, because I think I get the same sense with you. I'm interested in the interaction of the personal and the environment. You know, in other words, it's like what happens to one is also connected with so many things which are going on. Only one may not be aware of those things directly, like the Second World War, you know, until those soldiers come to our house and they, and for many months, you know, I mean, my mother's house was leaning on one side and so on, you know, so I always remember it and so on. But it's the interaction of the personal, the regional, the national, and the global has always fascinated me. And this is what emerged, I think, in his, you know, dreams in a time of war. And I really wanted to give, you know, that sense, you know. You know, for instance, let me give you an example. For instance, in the memoir, that is, how do we learn about, as children, about Hiroshima, for instance? It was part of the popular song among boys, you know. And we're talking, you know, the main singer would talk how heroic he was and so on. And then there would be a refrain, I've just come back from Burma to drop bombs in Japan. I don't know, the connection between Burma and Japan, where some are confused in the song and so on, you know. So now in writing this memo, I realized, of course, we're talking about a real historical event that, of course, now I know about. And so that interaction between the personal, the region, the national, becomes very fascinating to me. And the other thing which I realized, which is very interesting for the audiences here that's looking from America, is how much America was part of our lives. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up and going to school, I would not have thought there was any connection. I went initially to an independent African-run school in Kenya before they were abolished by the British during the colonial.
Right, in the book you explained that there were these two kinds of schools.
Yeah, and in writing this, I realized that the inspiration for those schools, the independent schools movement, was actually somehow connected with Booker T. Washington and Alabama. Yeah. Yes, how is that? You've heard of from Jamaica, Marcus Garvey, yes. Yeah. Marcus Garvey, you see, had heard of Booker T. Washington. But the thing which had attracted him in Booker T. Washington is not so much his politics, but rather the politics of self-reliance, that we can do things for ourselves. Now, the whole notion of self-reliance has a different meaning when put in the context of a colonial situation, you know. So Marcus Garvey came here, but Booker T. Washington had died before they could actually meet. But of course, Booker T. Washington, I know Marcus Garvey had this one of the biggest, you know, black movements in the world, and his journal, The Negro World or something, used to spread to all parts of the black world, including Kenya. And if we didn't realize that there is only now realize how much that journal was hunted down. You know, the British secret police and others, really, they were out to get that journal to prevent it from spreading. Now what happened, people would read it, and then orally, they would pass on some of his messages. I think one of the messages was, again, this question of self-reliance, independence. So the Kenyan schools run by Africans on self-reliance basis were called independent schools. Now, the word independent, again, has a very different meaning in a colonial context. In fact, initially, they were not even allowed to register the word independent, but they went ahead anyway and called themselves Independent Schools Movement. Okay? So that's the kind of connections in that right. are very, very sort of interesting. Huh?
It's amazing to me the parallels, hearing this and seeing the parallels with what's happened in a country like Morocco, which is so far, I mean, it's all in the northwestern tip of Africa, so far from East Africa, and yet the parallels are numerous. So, for example, when you mention independent schools in Morocco, they were called free schools. And it was the same thing. They were basically schools that were started by people who were in the independence movement and who wanted to be able to teach Arabic because you weren't allowed to teach Arabic in the mission schools where you were supposed to teach only French and French history and so on and so forth. And it's also interesting to hear these parallels with thinkers from outside of the country. So, you know, with Fanon and with people like Michael Max. I mean, these were huge figures, hugely important in the struggle for independence. Mm-hmm. I have so many questions.
It's really there. Particularly the African American experience.
Yes. And
They acquired. You know, it's very interesting that these figures acquired a different kind of impact. Mm-hmm. One of the leaders of the Kenyan independence movement was a young man called Bio Koinange, who came to Hampton Institute in Virginia in 1927. Okay? And that's where Booker T. Washington also graduated from the Hampton Institute, you know. And when this young man, Bio, later he graduated from Hampton Institute, he went to Columbia, got his first master's. When he went back to Kenya, he founded the first ever African-run teacher's college, you know, in Kenya. It was called Githogori, or Kenyan Teacher's College at Githogori, which was built by the efforts of the people themselves. Again, the British later not only made it illegal, but actually during the Mau Mau period, they turned it into a prison, as if to add insult to injury and so on. But anyway, this college was clearly modeled on the ideas of Booker T. Washington at Tuskegee. Yeah. So this is very interesting. And then during the war itself, in the evening, my brother was then in the mountains fighting against the British. But at home, there'll be whispers, and people are talking about black Americans coming to help us to fight the British. And one of my informants there was saying, oh, but they have their own problems, but still, you know, black Americans and South African blacks, they were coming to help us, you know, fight the British, you know. But later, I'm realizing that the reason why this kind of rumor became part of the folklore, if you like, of liberation, was actually during the Second World War. American soldiers, black soldiers, were stationed in Nairobi. And this Bio Koinange, who had come from Hampton Institute, invited them to the Guru Teachers College. And one of the things which had fascinated him when he was here was Negro spirituals. So he brought these soldiers to the Guru Teachers College, where they sang Negro spirituals or the spirituals. Now, I think the memory of those soldiers, you know, coming to sing the spirituals, oh, freedom and all that, may have been what was behind this rumor that they would come to help us. Yeah.
That's a great story. Earlier you were talking about how when we were discussing the familial relationships in the book and how it was served as a portrait for the country at that time, as a snapshot of what was happening in Kenya in those years. And it seemed to me actually to be a testament of the fact that when we talk about literature, oftentimes it's talked about as if it's supposed to be in its own sort of sphere. It's an art, but it's supposed to be sort of separate from, say, for example, politics. Do you see that there is a distinction between the two, or do you feel that there is?
Yeah, of course there's a distinction, but art, for me anyway, I don't know, I'm sure it's the same for it, is not something which exists in a realm of its own. It's connected with the now and then, or the reality of what is around us. You know, in fact, in a preface to this book, I've quoted a poem from Brecht, you know, called Mortal. You know, he said, you know, the person asks him, in the dark times, will there also be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. Yeah. You know, because the art... my little theory, I don't know, I'm sure you probably, you know, let me talk about my little theory on the role of arts in society.
Right.
And I'll be very, very brief, because if I start talking about this, I'll go on and on. But anyway, this is my little theory about the role of arts in society. We need, the body needs food and water for physical survival, correct? Yeah. I suppose the soul, wherever it is, or the whatever is served by the whole idea of ethics, you know, because there's ethical dimension of the human, and is largely embodied in religions or other rituals which have to do with the ethical or the spirit, our spirituality. Mm-hmm. So we have religion, you know, feeds the, you know, the soul and so on. Now, what about imagination? When you come to think of it, imagination is the most crucial thing about us. Because without imagination, we cannot do anything. We can't go anywhere. We cannot build, because we imagine things in our head. The architect imagines, like this building here. First of all, it's there in his head, imagined, before he puts down on paper. Religion, we worship with all the marvelous churches and mosques and so on, you know. We use imagination even to have an idea of God. Otherwise, I mean, it'd be impossible to even have religions and so on, you know. So imagination is so central, and we take it sometimes for granted. Now, of course, what we write and architect generally comes from the imagination, but like the soul, what feeds the imagination? What is that nourishes the imagination? It is the arts. They expand the imagination. They nourish the imagination. So in other words, art, whether it's literature or architecture, they don't need any other justification, because even as food, nourishment for the imagination, they are playing a crucial role in our being, because they expand the possibilities of the imagination and so on. Yeah.
So the reason that I bring this up is because, in what year was this? I don't want to misquote the year. It was sometime in the late 70s, early 80s, in Decolonizing the Mind, which is your manifesto, in which you argued that African writers have to use African languages in order to tell these African stories. And this was a hugely important book. And yet at the same time, I mean, your earlier work, obviously, with Weep Not, Child, with The River Between, A Grain of Wheat, all of these were written in English. But then thereafter, for example, with the play I Will Marry When I Want, that one was written in Gikuyu, and then the later books. So, for example, Devil on the Cross, Petals of Blood, and even Wizard of the Crow, which is your most recent novel, that was also written in Gikuyu, and you translated it yourself into English. But with this one, for example, with Dreams in a Time of War, That's written in English. And even Decolonizing the Mind is also written in English. And I'm curious how you decide, for example, with this book, to write it in English, or for example, with Wizard of the Crow, to write that in Gikuyu.
You know, first, in terms of the philosophy of that practice, you know, it's, again, what you said, it's rooted. Decolonize the Mind is rooted in the kind of thinking that you articulated in the connection with Morocco,
right,
where, you know, the Arabic mm-hmm. was not allowed. French was the language of instruction. So it's the same thing, of course, in a British sphere, you know, African languages, and all that. And I mentioned this actually in the decision which I have made so far. It's as if I have made a demarcation in my mind that all my novels, fiction, you know, theater, poetry, when I do some, is in Gikuyu language. But because of the needs of my profession and so on, you know, when it comes to explanatory prose and so on, like essays, academic essays and so on, I largely write those in English. Although the aim is eventually, when there's a community of intellectuals who use Gikuyu language as part of their intellectual discourse, you know, I should be able to. And in fact, I wrote, I'll tell you this. We have three language situations in Kenya. We have English, then Kiswahili, and each community has their own language, like Gikuyu language is my language. The other languages in Kenya, Luo, you know, Kikamba, you know, so many of them, okay? But they are languages in their own right. But I've not been very good with Kiswahili so far. But I'm reading a lot of Kiswahili lately. And it's sort of 2 weeks ago, I wrote my first critical work in Kiswahili, a review of a Kiswahili novel which I was reading, because there was marvelous, great writers in the Kiswahili language. And I did that. And I sent this to a friend who is a very good, you know, sort of, you know, on Kiswahili literature. And he wrote back and said, we must publish this. So my first critical work in Kiswahili, I mean, it's probably not more than 3 pages. But I'm so excited, as I see I'm writing for the first time.
Are you trying to tell us you're a novice writer in Kiswahili?
So it means at least I would. Maybe next time. I don't know, but let's see.
Do we have to wrap up? Do I have time for one more question? Okay. I guess I what I was going to say was this is such an important question and remains relevant for me, because even though I was born way after independence, this question of language and what language is used and what language we hear our stories in continues to be relevant, because I was exposed to French literature the entire time that I was a child, and there was no access to any other stories. So that's why I think it continues to be relevant, but I'm being told that we need to take questions, so there's a gentleman.
Jumbo.
Jumbo.
I had the pleasure of taking a course from you 40 years ago at the University of Nairobi.
Oh, well.
And it was a course in Caribbean literature. And I guess I never thought it was odd. I was in Kenya as a visitor and reading a lot of African literature, but all of a sudden I'm taking your course and reading Caribbean literature to which I hadn't been exposed. Why were you drawn to Caribbean literature to the point of teaching it?
Not only that, it's part of the... We are talking about, let me contextualize this for the audience a little bit. We are talking about 40 years ago, something like that. At least we are talking about 1960, earlier than that. We are talking about 1969, thereabout, you know. Because there was a very big revolution in the Department of English at the time. and a huge debate about the role of English and African literature and so on. But I'm glad to say, and I've talked about this actually in Decolonizing the Mind, and it's actually now, oh my God, this is very interesting. It's going to actually be the theme and subject of my, I'm giving some formal lectures at in May at Irvine, the Akodowelek Lectures. And actually, this is going to be one of the themes of those four formal lectures, Welek Lectures in Theory, because I'm revisiting that whole debate in the light of world literature today. But I can tell you, the audience, is that we were the first, if I remember right, to say, to put African literature at the center, Caribbean literature, African American literature, Latin American literature, Asian Indian literature, and then European literature in that context. So Caribbean literature, African literature, were also being taught also in the context of other literatures from Asia and Europe. So we were the first to say that Caribbean literature was worth of a serious academic study. African American literature was a subject of serious academic study in Africa and so on. And that tradition, fortunately, later spread to other parts of Africa. So it's one thing I'm very, very happy about in terms of my academic career.
So it's an opportunity for you to take a refresher course. Yeah. Oh, there's one back there.
And what do you about it, just quickly, the Caribbean intellectuals, just like African-American intellectuals, but in our case, even more so with the Caribbean intellectuals, they have played, this wild role. They are kind of wild intellectuals, like
Fanon,
Césaire, Kamau Brathwaite, George Lamming, Walter Rodney, Ciara James, these islands have produced figures which are larger than the islands themselves,
I was fascinated to hear you talk about Booker T. Washington, because coming through the American university system, I always think of W.E.B. Du Bois as the person who has the most kind of Pan-African experience, and Jomo Kenyatta was at the Pan-African Congress in the 40s. When did you become aware of Du Bois, and how important was he to your thinking?
Oh, Du Bois, of course, also, I mean, the ones who we are most aware of in a conscious sense is Du Bois, because of 1945, Pan-African Congress in Manchester, and because the whole Pan-African movement, and even some of the debates which Du Bois had with Booker T. Washington. And of course, most of us intellectually sided with Du Bois in that. So the surprise for me in writing this memoir was to see Booker Washington refusing to be making his presence known. It's almost like against me, against my conscious assessment of of those intellectuals. So what I'm really thinking is there are also all sorts of contradictions sometimes, or the laws of unintended consequences, because the whole notion of self-reliance. Imagine that in a colonial context, where people are being, their lands have been taken, they are being told their children they cannot do anything, but they're saying self-reliance translates actually into self-rule. Okay, so we're talking about self-rule against being ruled by the others. But of course, in terms of providing the vision of Pan-Africanism, which was very, very important, was, of course, there's no doubt Du Bois was a very, very important key figure, even today.
Good evening. Bonsoir, Leila. I'm Abdurrahman Wabri. I'm a writer from Djibouti. I'm very pleased to meet for the first time Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, on whose book I was fed on when I was a student back in Djibouti. And what we are talking about was also reminding of what my grandmother said, because she met those prisoners, Italian prisoners, at the time of the colonization. Oh. But actually, I was born later as a young man. And I do think that Mau Mau was one of the things that was evoked in my small district in Djibouti by the time, because I grew up in the time of French colonization. This is the 70s, and we're just writing Mau Mau just to make angry the French soldiers and to make to drive them crazy. And I again use this nowadays in my fiction. But actually, I'm very pleased to meet you, and I have a little gift that has to do with Pan-Africanism. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
I guess one last question, maybe? Okay, good.
This is less to do with ideas and more to do with materials. When you were introduced, it was said that for lack of materials, you wrote on toilet paper. And I just went, toilet paper? How is he lucky enough to get that? Because I just remember in many parts of Africa, squatting and washing with water. So you were jailed and you had access to toilet paper?
It's a very pragmatic question.
So yeah, very
the nitty gritty of the writing
very
process.
Very practical.
Can get into it.
Yeah, I was put in prison because of my writings in 1977, I believe. I was working in theater in Kenya in Kikuyu language, you know, in a village, and I think the post-colonial state did not like what we were doing and so on. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was arrested in December 1, 1977, when I was then professor and chairperson of the Department of Literature at Nairobi University. So from being a professor and author of three novels and so on, I found myself in a maximum security prison. On my left were chambers or section for the mentally deranged, you know, and then I said, well, for those who are condemned to die. So writers were somewhere between those two categories. Now, part of the punishment was not being allowed to have any books to read and so on. But they did give us, and I was never given a reason for my detention, by the way. I was never tried. I was just put in prison anyway. Now, but although they did not give us paper, they gave us one thing, toilet paper, okay? But the toilet paper they gave us was not the smooth type you have today, you know.
So it was rather perfect for writing.
I don't want to go into details, but anyway. they were more like, almost like this book, square, and rather hard. You know, we suspected they were meant to punish prisoners. But they were very good writing material. Actually, they all spent very, very... I've got samples with me at the University of California, Irvine, you know. So when I was in prison, in this maximum security prison, I realized that there was no point in asking the warders and others about what was going outside because they would never tell me. But also decided to break with English language because I argued, which I've also argued in Decolonizing the Mind, that since I've been put in prison, essentially, for writing in an African language, my own language, I thought that the best way of resistance is to write in the very language which was the basis of my incarceration. So, my first novel in Gikuyu language, which is now translated as Devil on the Cross, was actually written on toilet paper at the Kamete Maximum Security Prison. Yeah.
It's interesting because in Morocco, you see the same thing, that the novelists who were banned or who had any trouble were the ones who were writing in Arabic, but the ones who wrote in French, they were never the subject of censorship, because there were fewer people who were reading them anyway, and it never bothered the regime as much.
Yeah, the parallels are very, very interesting. This language question is very, very, very... it's not just African problem. It's very global, you know, actually, you know, because there's a book I wrote recently, you know, called Something Torn and New, you know, about this question. And I found the question of language was very important in the conquest of Ireland by the English. In fact, it's very interesting. Another connection with the American, let me just say this, I can't help it. Yeah. In 1569, Spencer, who was an English poet, because we have all read him and saw that, Spencer, the Fairy Queen and all that. But New Spencer was actually a settler in Ireland, in a region called Munster. And his neighbor was Walter Raleigh, the one who founded the colony in Virginia, or you remember him, Jamestown, or whatever, I don't know, it's one of those anyway. But they were neighbors, English settlers in Ireland. And Spencer, wrote his only prose work is a book called In the Present View of Ireland at the Present Time, published in 6th century, that year, 1569 or thereabout. In this book, which is structured like a Platonic dialogue between two people, he actually articulates a program for how to colonize the Irish and make them completely forget that they were Irish, because they'd be so resistant. The only way of breaking them was, one, their naming system, change them so they are no longer marks and O's, huh? So that way they would forget. In fact, he says that if you do that plus English language, they would forget the Irish nation. So the program for the erasure of the Irish memory of their nationhood. Okay? We're talking about 17th century. I don't know if there's a conscious connection, but I assume that since we are neighbors with Walter Raleigh, they must have been talking about some of these things in a way. And I'm not attributing too much, but it's very interesting. When Africans were brought here, you know, by force in the Caribbean as well, African languages were systematically, you know, destroyed. People are being punished, you know, for either found speaking African languages in a compound. In some cases, were actually their tongues, you know, particularly in the Caribbean, their tongues were actually be punished very severely, like one having one tongue pulled out or things like that. It was very, very brutal in terms of language, you know, destruction, conscious program of linguistic destruction. But anyway, I don't want to go into that. Quickly, sometime 2 years ago, I went to Wales, and I told the story of how we were made to carry a little placard around our necks if we were caught speaking an African language in our school compound, okay, to humiliate us. In Wales, they were made to do the same thing. If a child was found speaking Welsh in a school compound, they were made to carry a little placard with something like WN, Welsh not. Okay? So the story is very global.
Steve, one last
My question is, doesn't it make you open to criticism when you advocate for writers to write in their native language? For instance, if somebody listened to your argument and wrote only in Kikuyu or Kiswahili, isn't he losing the rest of the non-Kiswahili and non-Kikuyu world to share his, you know, the benefit of his wisdom? I mean, how do you reconcile that? Have you been criticized on that? I mean, I haven't read anything in terms of criticism. I have read your works advocating for this nativist writing, which I understand where you are coming from, but I'm sort of concerned about the global and the cultural interactions.
No, I think two things I would answer very, very quickly. In one, we should not worry about English or French very much because they can take care of themselves. And they've all taken care of themselves. They don't need any more advocacy, believe me. The languages that need advocacy are precisely the ones that do not have a voice. Anyway, no matter how, you know, that is, and I shouldn't worry very much about whether what I write is understood outside my community or not, except that in reality, there is the question of translation. And many of my novels, including the ones written in Kikuyu language, like Devil on the Cross, have been translated into Kiswahili and into English and into Swedish, into a few other languages. My novel recently, Wizard of the Crow, was written in Kikuyu language. I did my own translation into English, Wizard of the Crow. It has all been translated into Spanish, you know, the Spanish version, and a Finnish from Finland, Finnish version of the same novel and so on. So really, translations can enable books to grow, to be read all over. And by the way, do you know the two most influential books in the history of humankind? They're the two religious texts of the Quran and the Bible. The Bible, which I know best, is only known to many of us through translation. Let me tell you the story quickly. My English teacher was a Scottish teacher at my secondary school, not this one, the next school. And whenever we learned English, we wanted to use big words. You know, the way when you learn a new language, you don't want these simple words. You want the big ones. Then you can feel it, you know the language. Yeah? And so one of our students started by saying, one of class, you know, an essay started by saying, yesterday, as I was perambulating in the school compound, and the teacher was a little bit, he was saying, look, he was very cross, you know, about those Latin words, you know. He said, look, learn from Jesus. Jesus spoke very simple English.
And on that very cheerful note, thank you all so much for coming.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.